There was more violence in Iraq today as U.S. aircraft and tanks attacked Shiite militia positions in Baghdad's Sadr City slum. At least 10 people are reported dead. In addition, Britons await word on the British engineer held hostage after two Americans taken with him were beheaded. And there is news about a report that a high-profile Iraqi female prisoner might be released, a demand of the hostage takers. We'll have more about Iraq in a moment from NPR's Ann Garrels in our studio. And here now is Michael Goldfarb in London. But first, someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again. That's the pop hit Peace Train by the artist formerly known as Cat Stevens. Stevens, a Muslim convert, is now known as Yousef Islam, and the plane he took last night from London to Washington, D.C., was diverted to Maine after the Transportation Security Administration found his name on a list of suspected terrorists. Here is a TSA spokesperson.
As a precautionary measure, the TSA contacted the FAA and requested the aircraft be diverted to the nearest landing point, which was Bangor, Maine, to keep the plane from entering the Northeast Corridor airspace.
Well, that event took place the same day federal officials demanded that airlines turn over millions of passenger records so that the TSA can test its new anti-terrorist program, Secure Flight. Those records include passengers' names, addresses, telephone numbers, whether they requested special meals, even who they listed as travel companions. Washington Post reporter Sarah Gu is covering both these stories. She joins us on the line from Washington. And Sarah, to start, why Yousef Islam, Cat Stevens, why was he diverted?
Well, it was a bit of a shock to all of us last night to hear this. And U.S. officials would not speak on the record, but what they told us is that he has some kind of ties to, as we know, he's very active in the charitable giving in the Islamic community, and that he has supported some charities that allegedly might have some links to some terrorist groups. U.S. officials were not specific about, you know, which group or when, but they also noted that he had been prevented from entering Israel a number of years ago for similar reasons.
Well, if he really was a security threat, why wasn't he or his plane stopped before he took off from London?
Well, security officials wanted to know that themselves as well yesterday, because they didn't realize this until the plane was over the Atlantic Ocean last night. And before a plane takes off headed to the United States, airline agents are supposed to check every passenger's name against these various terrorist watch lists before allowing it to take off. And as a precautionary measure, the Customs Department does the same thing before the plane lands in the United States. So during that routine check yesterday afternoon, they realized that he was on the list and wanted that plane on the ground at the closest U.S. airport before entering U.S. airspace.
Let's briefly take a look at this proposed secure flight plan proposed by the TSA. What is it supposed to do, and how might it prevent this? How would it work?
Well, TSA officials said that the Yousef Islam incident highlights the need for why they need to come up with a better airline security passenger screening program and take it out of the hands of the airlines and instead do it themselves. Right now, there are U.S. intelligence agencies that are not really willing to share more complete lists of known and suspected terrorists because it is the airlines that do the checks. What TSA proposed yesterday is to take over that function and begin testing a program that will do that. And in doing so, yesterday they said they are going to soon order every airline in the country to turn over passenger records for every domestic passenger traveler who flew in June of this year, and they are going to do some tests to see if a new system they would like to launch will work.
Well, briefly, they say the new system will not scan for, let's say, violent criminals or people with outstanding warrants. They'll limit the scan just to terrorism. That was a complaint of privacy rights activists before. But, Sarah, in just the few seconds we have, what are privacy rights activists saying now?
They're saying the same thing. They don't see a huge change at all to this new proposal, as was talked about before, mostly because TSA still has not answered the fundamental question, what happens if they target the wrong person?
Yeah. Sarah Gu covers aviation security for The Washington Post. Sarah, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us.
Oh, sure, anytime.
And by the way, this new plan goes into effect. It's experimental now. When might it go into effect?
They believe spring of next year.
Okay. Thanks, Sarah.
Sure.
And now to Iraq. In the run-up to the war and in the weeks and months following the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, foreign correspondent Anne Garrels shared her observations with NPR listeners. Some of what she witnessed is featured in her book, Naked in Baghdad, and she's now back from Iraq with more observations. She joins us in the studio. Anne, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted.
First of all, what are some of the hotspots of the world you've reported from, and how does Baghdad compare?
I've been sort of all over the map, Kosovo, Bosnia, the first Gulf War, El Salvador, going back in time, and Chechnya, the wars around the Soviet periphery. I would say Baghdad is about as bad now as it gets, as bad as anything I've seen as a reporter.
On the basis of what? Of safety?
Safety.
Yeah.
Safety is... The security vacuum since the U.S. went in has been profound for everyone, Iraqis, American soldiers, and it has simply become worse. I have been living under maybe illusions, delusions, that as a woman I had it easier. Indeed, it was easier for me to move around. I could wear a scarf, you know, hiding my hair, a chador, in the back of the car. People didn't notice me that much. I certainly was more comfortable than my male colleagues from both NPR and other news organizations. But I think the attacks this week, in the last 10 days, in broad daylight, against houses, taking women and men, regardless, is a real wake-up call to all of us that, you know, we're simply not safe.
We understand that from one of the American contractors, both of them killed, obviously, but one of them had been saying to his family beforehand that he noticed that the Iraqi security detail that was assigned to the house had not been showing up, and there was this sense that there was no way for them to be secure because there would be no Iraqi who would dare defy an obvious force.
I think that's probably true. I mean, we've certainly seen this again and again, even with, you know, the new National Guard and the police. In April of last year, they basically did not fight. They don't know quite what they're fighting for. They are not well trained, and they are not sufficiently armed. That has been improving, but very, very slowly. Their numbers are not enough. And this again and again and again is what Iraqis say. Iraqis, in many ways, are caught between extremists on the one hand, who are extremely well-armed and getting better armed by the minute.
Where do they get those arms, by the way? Where do they get those?
Oh, the borders are incredibly porous. You know, that is one of the casualties of the war. The borders are porous. That's part of the security vacuum. Part of the problem is that, you know, the Americans went in, as it now turns out, with insufficient numbers. There is not great international support. The coalition partners, with the exception of the British, are not very well trained themselves, and certainly not very have not been great partners. We're talking, frankly, about the Poles, the Bulgarians, the Salvadorans, the Hondurans, the Filipinos, you name it. I mean, these are not well-trained, well-armed forces. They are there basically because they wanted to suck up to the United States.
So I didn't mean to stop your train of thought. Yeah. You said that the Iraqis are caught between the insurgents.
They're caught between the insurgents on the one hand and their suspicions of Americans on the other. And they don't yet know who they are. And they're fragmented amongst themselves, whether it's Kurds, Sunni, Shia, tribes, you name it. So it's... It is utterly predictable. I mean, the value of having been there in the run-up to the war for the 5 months before the war, and one reason why I wrote the book, was that Iraqis absolutely predicted completely the situation we now find ourselves in. They predicted that, you know, many would go underground and fight the U.S., whether they were Shiites or Sunnis. Not the majority, but...
It doesn't take a majority.
It does not. Not when they rule the streets with arms and guns and they're willing to fight. And, you know, middle class, nice middle class people who probably want an Iraq that's part of the world and that it's sort of a moderate Islamic country. You know, they don't count in the end when you've got these kinds of people. But they predicted the looting in the immediate aftermath. which did so much destruction, and that was not done just by the poor who came out to, you know, get what they could, but was clearly part of Saddam's plan to make it as difficult as possible for the United States once they came in. We don't have international support. You know, there are not enough troops. They're stretched thin, and they are doing everything. The civilians now are, you know, and have been for months and months and months, basically cowering and hiding for good reason inside the so-called green zone or in behind barricades, unable to do development and reconstruction. The military has really had to do, you know, assume many of the jobs that you know, would normally be civilian redevelopment.
Right. Or Iraqi jobs. I mean, there's a push to let the Iraqis rebuild their own country, but would they be then seen as collaborating with the U.S.? I mean, can they possibly?
They are now. There's no question. Increasingly, whether it's translators, Iraqis working for construction companies, drivers, you name it, they are being targeted and killed. And we don't have hard numbers, but the numbers are growing. And I can tell you one of my translators just 2 weeks ago was threatened. It was found out that he was working for us or he was working for Americans. It's unclear, and this is one of the problems for us. We don't know to what degree we are also being targeted. And he was told he would be killed if he continued to work. So he is now standing outside his house every day, washing the car, making it clear that he is not working for Americans, desperate to save his life.
And so the other things that happen there, he is not working. There's no income in that family.
That's right.
You lose your thread with Iraq.
I have other people working for me,
but
this could happen to them too.
Yeah.
And many translators working for both the American civilian administration, both for working with the Iraqis, Iraqi government officials. I mean, a daily log that we get and that, you know, can't be reported in detail every day because it's just not enough room in any, but we deal with over time, is, you know, Iraqi officials. It's political. It's purely criminal. They're going after doctors and doctors' families for pure cash. It's complete chaos.
We're talking with Anne Garrels, NPR foreign correspondent, who was in Baghdad about a month ago.
I got back on my last trip, yes.
Right, one of her 10 visits to the region in recent times. She's also author of Naked in Baghdad. That's a chronicle of the time she spent in Baghdad before and after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. And we have so many more questions, including, you know, what happens now? So if you'll just stay there for a second, we'll come right back and pose them to you. Be back with Anne Garrels in just a moment. Here and now, NPR's Anne Garrels is with us in the studio. She's also author of Naked in Baghdad, a chronicle of her time before and after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, time that you spent recording quite often in the buff. Should we explain that just before we move on?
Right, very quickly,
yeah,
if people don't already know. I mean, it was a ruse basically to get around Saddam's thugs, that if I didn't have any clothes on when they came around in the middle of the night basically looking for our satellite phones, and I showed a bare shoulder at the door, I hoped that they would give me, you know, 5 minutes to allegedly put clothes on, which time I would be able to hide the satellite phone. Mm-hmm. And the one time that they came around, I think they were so shocked to see an aging woman with a naked shoulder that they did give me the time.
Aging woman. I don't know. We'll have to revisit that another time. But we were talking about just how bad it is in Baghdad on a security level. We're hearing the news this week. Two Americans beheaded, Iraqis cowering in their homes, afraid to go out and work. Condoleezza Rice said just Tuesday that things have improved in Iraq in the last few months, despite the insurgency. Are there pockets in the country where there's great success?
I don't think there are pockets where there are great success. There are pockets where it is indeed calmer than it is in Baghdad, especially in the Shiite areas south of Baghdad. But it's capricious. I've been down in the villages in those areas. They haven't seen any American troops. They haven't seen any violence, but they haven't seen any improvement in their lives either. There's a shortage of medicines. There's rampant unemployment. A lot of the people in the villages used to work as truckers, but now they're frightened to work on the roads because of the roadside bombs and the attacks. It's not, you know, as violent in those places. But as an indication, you know, non-governmental organizations, which were working down in the Shiite areas, have for the most part pulled out because it is capricious.
Well, and as we said, it's virtually impossible to report on. It's that dangerous. Given all of this, what do you think the chances are of President Bush's appeal to the UN being successful? What are the chances of UN forces or other countries' forces coming in?
So far, we've seen little evidence that anybody is willing to offer up forces. Far from growing, the coalition so far has been shrinking. The British are talking about drawing down their numbers. There's a real question about whether the partners who are there now will re-up. So far from getting new people. And the Iraqis are extremely nervous about having their neighbors come in, whether it's Iranians, Syrians, Jordanians, you name it. Their immediate neighbors come in and help because they have, you know, quite tense relationships with them who, you know, Iraqis are very suspicious of their neighbors' intentions. And that, in fact, they may be helping the insurgents to some degree. There's no question that, for instance, Muqtada Sadr, the Shiite extremist, son of a charismatic Ayatollah, who has been leading an insurrection in the Shiite South against the United States. When the American troops recently fought him in the holy city of Najaf, the troops told me that there was no question that they were immeasurably better armed and better trained than they had been in April. So the question then occurs, okay, how and why? Probably with Iranian help. The interesting thing to me about that, though, and I would just say, is that, you know, Iraqis are very hard to help. You know, they're very fickle. They're very difficult. They resent the United States. I mean, there was one comment to me when the troops came in April, 17 months ago, and an Iraqi standing next to me said, "You understand that you will now have to be in complete control, and we will resent you every step of the way." Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the U.S. has been unable to be in complete control, and the resentment is even greater. So, you know, they want security, and then when steps are taken to try and create that security, they blame the United States, not the insurgents. Mm-hmm. However, in Najaf, what was interesting to me just in August when there was this battle, the U.S. went in along with the Iraqis. You have not had anti-American statements coming out of the local people there. They were terrorized and terrified by Muqtada Sadr. And since then, they have, in fact, had demonstrations saying to Muqtada Sadr, do not come back. Do not come back.
But doesn't this flag the other thing that we're hearing this week, the security reports that have come out that say, at worst, the situation in Iraq could lead to civil war? Yeah, you're nodding yes.
I think that that's quite possible. I mean, this, you know, as many Iraqi, Amr, who worked with me up to, during, and continues to be one of my closest friends in Iraq, described it to me, you know, it's like as if you've thrown a rock at the mirror and it shattered and he can't see the future. I mean, your initial question to me was, so what happens next? I don't think anybody knows, but it is fragmenting and fracturing. Of that, there is no question.
Mm. And, Garrels, we're going to have to let you go with one last question. Are you going back to Baghdad? Can you go back to Baghdad?
At the moment, I am planning on going back to Baghdad. You started at the very beginning asking me what I had covered in the past. And I covered, I mean, probably the worst war before this that I covered was Chechnya. And there came a point where we all stopped going. It's much worse in Baghdad now than it was in Chechnya when we stopped going to Chechnya. But, of course, there weren't 135,000 troops in Chechnya. There wasn't the sense that we really needed to be there as witnesses on the ground day in, day out. I think we feel we do need to be there, and we're continuing to stay there. But I don't know how much longer we can be there.
And we understand that the reporters there, Peter Kenyon, Emily Harris, it's sort of a MASH operation when they get in the car to go out very carefully.
Absolutely, with good reason.
Ann Garrels, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ann Garrels, foreign correspondent for National Public Radio and author of Naked in Baghdad. Tomorrow on Here and Now, should Rumsfeld go? Will Powell stay? And who would advise a President Kerry? We'll take a look at the potential cabinets in the next administration and meet a man who says the candidate should announce this inner circle during the campaign. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. Today would have been the 49th birthday of Jack Hensley, a celebration. But Hensley has instead become the second American hostage to be beheaded this week by terrorists in Iraq. Hensley's brother Ty spoke on NBC's Today show this morning.
What has happened will echo around the world for a day or two, but it will resonate in my family for several generations. The world will fall on the shoulders of a young girl, a 13-year-old child, who someone has to tell what happened to her father.
Meanwhile, Britons are waiting to hear the fate of Kenneth Bigley, who was also taken hostage by the militant group connected to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. That group has been demanding the release of Iraqi women held in prison by American forces. Today, there were reports that at least one of those women was to be released, but U.S. authorities have denied that. Here with more on this and other news from America's strongest ally in the war in Iraq, Here Now's Michael Goldfarb on the line from London. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Robin.
Michael, what is true that we can know? This female prisoner reportedly set to be released is Rehab Taha. She's known as Dr. Germ for her work on Saddam's anthrax program back in the 90s. Is she being released?
Well, this is where it gets confusing, Robin. The Iraqi Ministry of Justice earlier today announced that it was likely to release her quite possibly within the next couple of days. They said it was something that had been planned. They'd been reviewing her case. She's been in custody since May 2003, just after the war, and has no more operational information that requires her detention. And the Ministry of Justice also said that the other woman in American custody, Huda Hamash, who also worked on chemical and biological programs for Saddam, is likely to be released as well. Now, this came after Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi had been visiting in Downing Street, and there was some sense that, you know, perhaps this was something that had been arranged through Downing Street. The Prime Minister's office issued a statement calling the whole move an extraordinary and complicated coincidence and denied asking the Iraqi authorities to make the move. And then just to add complication, the Pentagon says that, no, there's no plan to release the women at all.
Right. And, of course, it could be interpreted by the group that they've won, that their demands were met.
Exactly. In the midst of all this back and forth, there is a single human being whose life hangs in the balance.
How has the British family been reacting to this horrible situation?
Well, they've made personal representations in a phone call with Tony Blair, begging him to use whatever influence he has with the Iraqi government to release the women. And they've, you know, been all over the airwaves saying, much the same thing.
Yeah. Okay, and then the bigger framework here is, of course, the ongoing situation in Iraq. We understand that Tony Blair is now calling this current stage of conflict in Iraq a new war. What does he mean?
What he means, I think, is that we can take from something he said at a press conference with Iyad Alawi 2 days ago. He called on the British people to give support to a new campaign. And he said, quote, whatever the disagreements about the first conflict in Iraq to remove Saddam, in this conflict now taking place, this is the crucible in which the future of global war on terrorism will be determined. So it's like he's making a distinction between the war to overthrow Saddam and the conflict that's going on now. I think he's looking for a rhetorical way to explain the fact that the occupation has gone badly, badly awry.
Well, and that might have something to do with the story there, which parallels one here, the release of previously secret documents about investigations. The Daily Telegraph this weekend printed confidential papers from the Foreign Office, warnings given to Blair by Foreign Secretary Jack Straw as early as a year before the war. And apparently these papers warned Blair about an upcoming meeting he was to have with President Bush to talk about the possibility of overthrowing Saddam. Again, that's a year before the war was launched. And the quotes are extraordinary. Do you have them there?
Yeah, I do. You know, in one memo, and no one has denied the veracity of these memos, Straw writes to Blair in advance of a meeting at the ranch in Crawford, "The rewards will be few. The risks are high, both for you and the government." And then there's another memo in which he tells Blair, quote, "No one has satisfactorily answered how there can be any certainty that the replacement regime will be any better." Mm-hmm. Now, this is obviously from a period when the war was being discussed, and you know the discussions had yet to be made public. But the warnings were there, and things have panned out much as the warnings said they would.
Right. And how are the British reacting to this?
Well, a YouGov poll, this is an online polling organization, just released a poll that showed 38% of people now believe the war was worth fighting, and that's down from 66% just after Saddam's statue was toppled in April 2003. Another poll shows 71% of the public want Tony Blair to set a date for the withdrawal of British troops from Iraq. And as recently as May, almost half the British voters said they thought troops should stay for as long as necessary.
So on that front, and with the new news today, I mean, another car bomb exploded in Baghdad today, killing 10 people. We hear there are skirmishes in other parts of Baghdad, killing at least 10 in one instance, injuring 92. An American soldier was killed in an ambush. Anne Garrels told us earlier in the program that there are reports of a drawdown of British troops.
Yeah, this report appeared in the Observer newspaper over the weekend. It was written by someone who was actually reporting from Iraq. Currently, there are 8,000 troops, British soldiers, in Iraq. 5,000 are there for combat. The rest are support troops. And the next troop rotation, fresh soldiers, is set to happen in October. And the report said that some of the combat troops will not be replaced. Now, I checked with the Ministry of Defense here. Their line is that no troop reduction is being contemplated, but British troop numbers are constantly reviewed. So I guess we'll have to see what happens towards the end of October.
Right. Well, that's the British side of the story. What about the U.S. side of the story as it's playing out in Britain? Is the American election being covered extensively? I'm sure it'd be covered some, but how extensively?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's covered extensively. Mm-hmm. This is a big story. I mean, I've lived here a long time, and U.S. elections come and go, but this is now something that affects everyone's life. And it's not just covering what is said in America. Opinion research. If Europeans had a vote, would they back Kerry over Bush? Who would they vote for? I mean, this public opinion poll, it has been circulating through the paper. It showed that George Bush would win just 6% of the vote in Germany, 5% in Spain, 4% in France. And, you know, these are countries where the conservative parties poll regularly, 25, 30, 35% of the electorate. So you get a sense of how people feel about the American president.
And of course, Michael, there are many supporters of President Bush who would see that as a positive, that Europe doesn't support him in this upcoming election.
Well, the most interesting thing is, you know, to watch the president give his talk at the UN yesterday, clearly a talk that's aimed much more at the American electorate than to the assembled representatives, whereas here people look at the UN as the main forum for international discussion and debate. So people see almost two different events happening in one single speech.
Michael Goldfarb, he's speaking to us from his home in London, England. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Still to come, a political ad man who's worked for Ralph Nader and Jesse Ventura says open up the two-party system to other voices. Well, we'll listen. You're listening to Here and Now. Accusations of blood doping have hit the American Olympic team for the first time. Marblehead, Massachusetts native Tyler Hamilton is at the center of the controversy. Hamilton won gold last month in the men's road cycling individual time trial, and he is now under investigation for alleged blood doping. Here now's Martha Biebinger has more on the story.
The Athens Olympics are the first games where athletes have faced sanctions for blood doping. If found guilty, cyclist Tyler Hamilton would lose the gold medal he won last month. Hamilton says the idea that he would arrange transfusions to boost his red blood cells' oxygen transporting capacity is ridiculous.
I've always been a clean rider. I've always been a fair rider. I've been accused of taking blood from another person, which, if anybody knows me, knows that that is completely impossible.
But two preliminary tests indicate the presence of someone else's blood in Hamilton's samples. One was taken on August 19th during the Olympics, and another one during a bike race in Spain last week. Tests are not considered conclusive unless a second analysis of the same sample is positive, and the results aren't usually released until both tests are complete. Hamilton questions the reliability of the process.
I know I'm innocent. I know I didn't participate in that, so if it does come out positive, then there's a flaw in the test for sure. You know, don't forget, it's a new test. It's a first-time result.
Phonak, the company whose team Hamilton rides for, says the results indicate probability, not certainty. But doctors who have reviewed the use of blood doping tests say there are clear differences between host and outside red blood cells. New York University professor Dr. Gary Wadler is a member of the World Anti-Doping Agency.
Before these tests are introduced, they really scrutinize extensively to make sure they can withstand the challenges that athletes have been known to put forward in trying to defend their reputations and so on.
News of the doping allegations launched shockwaves through the biking world and Hamilton's hometown of Marblehead. Chris Finn owns the Marblehead Bike Shop.
I definitely don't believe it. I really feel strongly just knowing Tyler, and to me it's just not his character. It's got to be a mistake.
The editor-in-chief of Bicycling Magazine, Steve Madden, says Hamilton is the last person he'd suspect of doping. But Madden is torn between suspicions about what he says was Hamilton's unusually strong performance in the Olympics and his own admiration for a man who finished last year's Tour de France with a broken collarbone.
When I take off my sports writer's hat and start thinking like a fan, it makes me really sad, because if it is true, it would really hurt that this is what we would remember rather than the heroic effort he made in the 2003 Tour or the great races he's had in Europe, and rather not remember Tyler Hamilton as a cheat.
But Madden says the damage to Hamilton's reputation is there, even if he's cleared of any wrongdoing. If the latest round of tests is positive, Hamilton would likely be suspended from racing for up to 2 years as a first-time offender and lose his Athens medal. The International Olympic Committee is not commenting on this case. Hamilton says he'll fight at every level of appeal possible.
Here now is Martha Biebinger with audio assistance from Radio 24 in Zurich, Switzerland. Well, joining us now is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. And Bill, your brief thoughts. You've been following Tyler's career. What do you think of the allegations?
Well, the allegations are exceptionally ironic, because Tyler Hamilton, of all the riders that I know anything about, has been one of the most determined to bring good testing to his sport and to make sure that it's a clean sport. Numbers of people that we've talked to beyond the folks that Martha Biebinger had talked to have echoed what her sources have said, though, that they believe Tyler.
Well, and is there a sense that these tests are unreliable?
Well, I think there's a sense that they're unreliable because they're new. and they don't have the data that mm-hmm. would have resulted from a dependable test that had been catching people cheating for years. And so to that extent, yes.
And what about the other thing that was mentioned? Is there also a whiff, though, of why did Tyler do so well in the Olympics?
Nobody has suggested that when I've asked around. People have said that one characteristic of Tyler Hamilton's career is that he gets a little better, a little better, a little better all the time. He's never shown in his performances, according to the people that I've spoken to, that astronomical improvement, that mm-hmm. gigantic, you know, upsurge in the curve that sometimes is characteristic of people who suddenly find a chemical way to improve their performances.
Right. And this was the little better that got him the gold medal,
mm-hmm.
according to these people.
Right.
Well, we will keep an eye on this story. Bill Littlefield, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Here and now. First, a brief update on two stories we've been watching. A grand jury in Texas has handed up 32 indictments alleging a scheme involving illegal campaign contributions and a political action committee with ties to House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. DeLay was not charged or questioned in the investigation, which centers around corporate contributions made in the 2002 legislative races in Texas. DeLay says the prosecutors are using the investigation for political purposes in a presidential election season. And the hurricane season has ravaged Haiti, its defoliated land unable to hold the torrents of rain and mud delivered by Tropical Storm Jean. The death toll from Jean has climbed to more than 700, 600 corpses from one town alone. 1,000 more Haitians are missing, and over a quarter of a million are homeless today. Jean has regained hurricane strength over the open Atlantic and may hit the Florida coast this weekend. Political ad man Bill Hilsman has worked for third-party candidates like Jesse Ventura and Ralph Nader. But this year he's waging his own independent campaign to change the American two-party system. Hilsman says more choices on the ballot make voters more involved. Of course, some backers of Al Gore in 2000 might disagree with that cheery assessment, but Hilsman says he has solutions that would prevent independent candidates from tanking another candidate's campaign. And his ideas are explored in his new book, Run the Other Way, Fixing the Two-Party System One Campaign at a Time. Bill joins us in the studio. And, Bill, I'm guessing some people are saying great timing, it's an election year. Let's look at this two-party thing. Others are saying your timing could not be worse. After the debacle of 2000, I didn't even want to hear about a third-party candidate, especially one you worked with.
Well, I think that people who are blaming Ralph Nader for what happened in 2000 aren't thinking very deeply. Let's face it, Al Gore really underperformed in 2000, and George Bush overperformed in 2000. And a lot of that had to do with independent voters deserting Gore and going to Bush.
But you know, the broader point is that a lot of people feel that really in this day and age, do independent parties, independent of the two major parties, really do anything but act as little gnats, you know, really just sort of picking away? And do they really do anything more than that?
They actually decide every election, and they decide every election in the swing states. It is true, I think, this year that the undecided vote is lower earlier than it's been in most presidential elections of years past. But that 5 to 7%, however many voters you think that is, that 5 million, 7 million independent voters are going to decide this election in swing states. Where they go is where the election goes. You saw that in 2002. When most of the independents all went Republican, and that led to the Republican midterm blowout.
What are you saying in your book? Are you saying that the third party should be strengthened? Are you saying that the two main parties should be fixed? What are you saying?
I'm saying that the two main parties have way too much power right now, that they are less concerned about their candidates and about winning elections, and certainly not very concerned at all about serving the people. And they're much more concerned about proliferating their own power and the perpetuation of their organizations and, quite frankly, their paychecks.
And, you know, someone say, so what do you do? It seems so cemented at this point. And you're a part of the political process.
Well, people want more choices. I firmly believe that. And however those choices become available to them, whether it's through additional parties, new and different candidates, a different way of voting, I'm in favor of looking at all of that. I know that the system is not, it's not working. It's not serving, as I say in the book, it's not serving candidates and it's not serving voters. So I question an electoral system that, that can't do either of those two things.
You tick through in the back of the book different things that you would do. Could you tick some of them off now?
I'm a big fan of instant runoff voting, of having people feel less like they have to vote against somebody and not for something. If you can rank your candidates and your vote and weight that favorability that you have for the candidates in a given race, I think that that's better for everybody involved.
What do you mean? Explain that. In other words, if there's what do you mean?
I mean that if there were four candidates in a race, for instance, as there was in the 2000 presidential race, that you wouldn't feel that you necessarily had to cast a vote for Gore to cast a vote against Bush. You could have cast a vote, number one, for Nader, number two, Gore, number three, maybe even Buchanan if you wanted to, if you were really against Bush, and number four for Bush, or vice versa. But that makes it less of constantly voting against something and allows you to really rank your favorability and your candidates out there.
You say get the money out. Everybody's tried to get the money out.
Actually, you can get the money out. You can get the money out by being a lot more efficient and a lot more effective in the ways that our campaigns are run. One of the ways the Election Industry, Inc., as I call it, disserves candidates is that they're complicit with the media that makes money off of these elections. As an advertising agency, I'm a fiduciary agent for my commercial client. I have to go out and get the best possible deal I can get for my commercial client. It's not that way in politics. The consultants who make money off the media buys are complicit with the media people who keep raising the rates. And the guys who get ripped off, the people who get ripped off are the candidates.
Nobody's crying for them, though. Why is that?
But look at what happens when you've got a system that works that way. Only rich people can run because the cost of elections keeps getting ratcheted up. You can't run for the U.S. Senate anymore unless you're a multimillionaire.
Or unless you get lucky in a couple of ways. I'm thinking of your candidate in 2000, Ralph Nader. You crafted the ad for him. Did you craft that priceless ad?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, our strategy for Ralph in 2000 was because we had very little money to do mass media advertising with, that we would tap into commercial campaigns that the public was already familiar with. So we came up with a variant on the MasterCard priceless commercial.
Campaign ads filled with half-truths. $10 million. Promises to special interest groups. Over $10 billion. Finding out the truth. Priceless.
There are some things. Didn't you get in a little trouble over that one?
Yeah, it wasn't me so much as the campaign. The campaign was sued for $5 million by MasterCard, which probably helped us more than hurt us. It drew a lot more attention to it. And that lawsuit was eventually thrown out. We knew right away that we were going to win it because their request for an injunction was denied by the judge, and the judge signaled that it just wasn't a viable case.
You talk about fixing the two-party system, but also fixing the people who run the races. Can you just tick off some things you would say to people who are running campaigns?
Well, I think our campaigns are far, far, far too poll-driven, and that's a reason for the artificiality in a lot of campaigns, the phoniness in a lot of campaigns. I think polling is a huge, political polling is a huge waste of money.
You say too, the field work, boots on the ground, is so much more effective, and we saw that in the Iowa caucuses.
One of the points I make in the book is that it's tough to be a volunteer. It's tough to canvass voters, and your life is made so much more easy if there's a good TV ad out there. Then people want to talk about the ad. They know a little bit about the candidate. It just makes life a lot easier for door-to-door canvassers.
It has to go hand in hand.
Exactly.
Well, Bill Hilsman, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bill's book is called Run the Other Way, Fixing the Two-Party System One Campaign at a Time. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.